Call Hess Committee to order at this time. We have a full House present. Senator Dyson, Senator Eaton by Vice Chair, and Senator Ellis, and Senator Mars. Myself, Betty Davis, is Chair. We have one bill to come before us today. We're going to spend an hour on that bill because we do have a presentation to be done by Keeler House. We're going to ask that Senator Willikowski and his staff come forward. The bill that we're going to hear is Senate Bill 27, Flame Retardants and Toxic Chemicals.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Willikowski. I am State Senator for Northeast Anchorage. And I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill today. This is a bill that I sponsored last year, made it through this committee, and there was also a bill on the House side. And I think as we move along and people gain further knowledge about this bill, I think this is an important bill. And I think when we talk about what is the role of government, I think most of us would agree that there is no greater role for us than to protect our kids, to protect our families. And here is an opportunity for us to do that, Madam Chair. This bill would phase out the use of flame retardants, PBDEs, as they're known. And these substances are believed to cause numerous health problems, which my staff will get into a little bit more in detail. They're found in much higher concentrations here in Alaska for two reasons. Number one, the PBDEs are concentrated in soluble fats of subsistence animals, and so they're actually found in very high doses in Yupik women. The studies have shown that. Another reason that this problem is particularly bad in Alaska is because it's very cold here. People seal themselves up in their houses, and this is where you find PBDEs everywhere. I don't think most people realize that when they put their child down on a mattress, when they put their child in their pajamas, when their child crawls on the floor, when they use a cell phone, when they use a microwave, they are very likely being exposed to toxic chemicals, toxic PBDEs. Here's an opportunity for us to take an action to protect the people of our state. There are safer alternatives. There are safer alternatives that are just as cost effective. And other states have done this, Madam Chair. So I think this is an important bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. My staffer, Carla, will go into a little bit more detail, and I would urge your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We do have a CS before us also that we probably need to adopt, and before you give your remarks, I'll ask for a motion on the CS. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair.
Madam Chair, I move that we move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 27.
Objection.
You object?
Just to have somebody
explain. Well, I was going to object, and I'll let you do that.
Just to tell us what the changes are.
We're going to get to that point, what the changes are, because I thought she had some comments to be made first. I was just adopting it so we could move smoothly into it. But that is your intention to go through the bill, right? And to tell what the changes are?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I remove my objection.
All right, thank you. But I'll keep mine there so it's on the table and you may take over at this time. And I didn't get your name.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Carla Hart, and I'm an aide to Senator Willikowski.
Yes.
Thank you. In preparing for this meeting, I've reviewed piles of literature, listened to testimony before your committee last year, spoken with experts, and looked to other states. Now my challenge to provide you with a succinct statement to the problem before you and how Senate Bill 27 addresses that problem. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson came to my rescue in a speech to the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco in September 2009. She has pulled together the heart of the problem and the history of why this bill is before you in about 2.5 minutes. It would take me much longer. So with your permission, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson's words. A child born in America today will grow up exposed to more chemicals than a child from any other generation in history. A 2005 study found 287 different chemicals in the cord blood of 10 newborn babies. They were found in children in their most vulnerable stage. Our kids are getting steady infusions of industrial chemicals before we even give them solid food. As more and more chemicals are found in our bodies and the environment, the public is understandably anxious and confused. Many are turning to government for assurance that chemicals have been assessed using the best available science and that unacceptable risks haven't been ignored. Right now, we are failing to get this job done. Our oversight of the 21st century chemical industry is based on the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act. It was an important step forward at the time, but over the years it's been proven an inadequate tool for providing the protection against chemical risks that the public rightfully expects. Manufacturers of existing chemicals aren't required to develop the data on toxicity and exposure needed to assess potential risks and demonstrate to EPA that chemicals meet risk-based safety standards. On new chemicals, companies have no legal obligation to develop new information, only to supply data that may already exist. As with existing chemicals, the burden of proof falls on EPA. Manufacturers aren't required to show that sufficient data exists to fully assess a chemical's risks. If EPA has adequate data and wants to protect the public against known risks, the law creates obstacles to quick and effective action. Since 1976, EPA has issued regulations to control only five existing chemicals determined to present an unreasonable risk, five from a total universe of almost 80,000 existing chemicals. In 1989, after years of study, EPA issued rules phasing out most uses of asbestos, an exhaustively studied substance that has taken an enormous toll on the health of Americans. Yet, a court overturned EPA's rules because it had failed to clear the many hurdles for action under the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act. Today, advances in toxicology and analytical chemistry are revealing new pathways of exposure. There are subtle and troubling effects of chemicals on hormone systems, human reproduction, intellectual development, and cognition. Every few weeks, we read about new potential threats. Many states have stepped in to address these threats because they see an inaction at the national level. And those are Lisa Jackson's words and bring us to Senate Bill 27 before you today. I can run through a sectional of the bill at this time along with the changes from the original Senate Bill 27 and the CS, with your permission. First, I might just briefly address the changes and then go right to the CS. The changes on page 2, line 6, the original version created a loophole and mentioned brominated PBDEs specifically, meaning that if a PBDE were brominated but not specifically listed in the first part of the bill, that it would still be allowed. And so this just took it out and allows DEC to look at any fire retardant. On page 4, line 2, we deleted a section under the High Production Volume Challenge Program. The purpose of this was to just let DEC use whatever data EPA has rather than limiting them to information from one program. On page 5, line 13 through 15, we changed the definition of bioaccumulative to be more scientifically accurate based on consultation with a biologist. And similarly, on page 5,
I haven't go back over to page 13 you just mentioned.
Okay, page 5, lines 13 through 15. The original definition for bioaccumulative wasn't really scientifically correct according to a biologist, and so he gave us some better language that explains that it's when an animal has a toxicity greater than the environment in which it's living. Okay. And then on page 5, lines 16 and 17, addresses the definition of persistent. All toxins transform or break down in the environment. The time change can be seconds or millennium, but they're all changing at some point. The new definition acknowledges the change and degradation over time, and that some chemicals degrade into even more toxic forms before they reach an inert level, if ever. So those are the only changes that were made to the in the CS.
Okay. And do you plan to go do the sectional at this time?
I will do the sectional at this time if you would like. So you all have the sectional that Legislative Affairs provided in your book tab or in your handout tab with sectional. And rather than reading that back to you, right, I'll just highlight the point. Section 1 puts a ban on three types of PBDEs. It provides DEC with the ability to ban other fire retardants if they deem that they are dangerous and that acceptable alternatives exist. It provides exemptions to address some specific concerns relating to transportation, industrial, the plastic on transmission wires. It provides enforcement, and I would describe this as a somewhat gentle enforcement. The enforcement hand isn't going out to the retailers. The intent of this bill is not to have DEC running around to furniture stores busting anyone. The intent is that the manufacturers and importers of goods need to provide information that shows that they're selling safe products. It directs the state to review risks and possible alternatives to brominated fire retardants. It builds Alaska's knowledge of toxics by developing a list of all types of persistent bioaccumulative toxins that are used in products used by people. So in this part of the bill, we're jumping from fire retardants specifically to saying at a national level, we're not looking at toxins in a way that's protecting us. And so let's build our knowledge base a bit at the local level. And it also allows the state to participate in an interstate clearinghouse on toxics to pool information and resources. As you know from from the EPA's remarks, Lisa Jackson's remarks, because the federal government isn't able to offer us this protection at this time, many states have been enacting legislation and pooling together to share information. Sections 2 and 5 allow the department to begin adopting regulations immediately. Section 3 directs that the first list of toxins be established by February 1st, 2014. Section 4 is revisor notes, and Section 6 puts the overall effective date of January 1st, 2013. This bill follows model legislation that's been enacted in other states, and in your packet there's a tab for NCSL with a National Conference of State Legislatures summary of legislation passed. States that have already implemented this, including our nearest neighbor, Washington, don't seem to have any problems with the implementation. Washington, as of January 1st this year, went into full implementation. The science exists to demonstrate the danger of the toxins. I'll refer you to the San Antonio statement in your packet. 197 people from around the world, 30 countries, have signed on to this as of November of 2010. Alternatives exist. There's a Washington report in your packet that talks about their investigation of alternatives and approval by their fire marshal of the alternatives as providing acceptable fire protection. And firefighters across the country support this legislation. Fires with toxic flame retardants present additional risks to the firefighters. So the Federation of Firefighters has been a strong supporter of this, and you will see a tab that has some firefighter information as well. There are experts online to testify, and they are the ones for the technical questions that will better be able to answer them than will I. And I could, you have a list of the testifiers, I believe, Madam Chair.
I do know, yes.
So I could pause now, perhaps.
Before we begin the public testimony, is there anything that the members want to ask of the sponsor at this time? Yes, Senator Dyson?
Yeah. I believe that the EPA is taking some action on some kind of a phase out of this. Is that true? And if so, what's wrong with their plan?
It is true that they are taking some action within the ability that they have to take action. I spoke with someone at EPA about this on Thursday, and he said that they have some draft plan to take care of or to address the PBDEs, DECA PBDE, at review at Office of Management and Budget right now. He doesn't know when that will be out. Said that in the best case scenario, they might be able to have some action on it in 9 months. But the challenge with this is that it doesn't have any real teeth, and it's all based on voluntary compliance of the manufacturers. And it doesn't address anything if there's importation of products and there's an increasing amount of foreign manufactured or built furniture coming into the country. And the voluntary stuff with EPA doesn't have any ability to address any of the imported materials. And basically from speaking to the EPA and seeing the words of Lisa Jackson, they're feeling that they don't have the ability to do what they need to do to protect people.
If there's nothing else, then we'll go into the public testimony. And I'll start off net. Is there Jefferson Wood? Jefferson Wood?
Hi, Madam Chairman. Good afternoon, Senators. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about the Senate bill. My name is Jefferson Wood. I'm a resident of the Kenai Peninsula. I live down in Seward, and I'm just calling on behalf of myself today. I heard about this bill last year, and then I saw that it came back up when I was looking at the Newsliner a week or so back. They did a story on there. And I was listening to the testimony of the aide, and, you know, it got me thinking. I had prepared some remarks, but her testimony got me thinking. And you know, every day we're exposed to chemicals. People that are sick take chemicals to make themselves feel better, chemicals that have side effects, but the effects of the chemicals are far more beneficial than the potential side effects. She was expressing chemicals as if they were a bad thing per se. Now, with PBDEs, and I'm not a chemist by any means, may be bad, but you don't know that. Even in the sponsor statement, he says that they've been studying this for 30 years and yet have fully realized what potential problems there may be with this. Representative Kawasaki in his report or in the article in the Newsminer stated that the scientific community is calling for caution, but suggests that the science or the legislators are still, quote, digging through the science behind this issue. So we're taking action on something that it seems that the legislature has no basis or knowledge of fact on, and that concerns me. It concerns me as a consumer. It concerns me as somebody that knows that while there's some argument that these chemicals may have an effect, I know that fire has an effect. And, you know, when I start thinking, well, if I go replace my mattress, am I going to get one that is more flammable, one that's going to be less safe for my family when, you know, I'm locked in my house with a wood-burning stove? These are questions that don't seem to be brought up. Now, I've heard them talk about alternatives to these chemicals. I understand that this is a bill that's not supposed to have much enforcement, but we haven't been given any specifics about these alternatives. If there are safer, cost-effective alternatives, then what argument would industry have for not using them? Why would you need legislation to implement them or to call for their implementation? You know, so the fact of the matter is that the EPA has banned only five chemicals in the time frame that the aide had spoken about this because of exactly what Senator Wachowski had called for in a sponsor statement. So one more thing, fellow citizens. A wise and frugal government shall not restrain men from injuring, or shall restrain men from injuring one another, including making my household goods more flammable. And they should leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread that is earned. This bill stands in complete contradiction to Thomas Jefferson's words. I applaud you for wanting to look at this issue and wanting to take action to make sure that the health and the well-being of those of us in Alaska is looked out for, but I don't think this bill does it. And I don't think it did it last year. I don't think it does it this year. And I think that if there are issues concerning these PVDEs, that they will be brought forth in the proper venue. I just don't think this is it. And so I do thank you for taking the time. I do thank you for considering the bill, but I would urge that you vote it down. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Yes. Senator Dyson.
This question is not disrespectful today. In hearings like this, it might be good for you to ask all the folks who testify if they have any financial interest in the decisions on it. If you don't mind, I'll ask this. Sir, are you related to any industry that be affected by this?
Through the chair, I am not financially invested in this issue at all. Like I said, it's something that I read. I'm somebody that likes to follow the events of what's happening in my state, and as I told the person when I called in, I'm simply representing myself and my family.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. That's the kind of citizenship we want. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. No other questions. We'll go to Ted, I'm not able to pronounce your last name. It says Science Environmental Health Network.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 27. My name is Ted Shetler. I'm the Science Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. I'm a physician and also have a degree in public health with training in toxicology. And I have no real or perceived conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. These compounds, PVDEs, are present in food, wildlife, human blood, human milk, placentas, and fat tissue. DECA-BDE has 10 bromine atoms on the molecule. Other flame retardants from the same family have fewer. Octa, for example, has 8, and Penta has 5. As we've heard, a number of states have banned these chemicals from commerce because of health concerns, and I will focus my comments on them. People are exposed to these chemicals in various ways, through contaminated food, inadvertent house dust ingestion, inhalation, and perhaps through skin absorption. Younger children are more highly exposed than adults. PBDEs have adverse effects on the liver, kidneys, and reproductive system in animal studies. DECA is classified by the EPA as a possible carcinogen. But most human concerns focus on the effects of PBDEs on the developing brain, since they occur at far lower levels of exposure. In multiple studies in laboratory rodents using well-accepted testing protocols, Octa, Penta, and DECA BDE cause persistent hyperactivity after administration of a single, relatively low dose in the first few days of life. Learning and memory are also impaired at slightly higher doses. Some of these effects worsen with age. Scientists generally agree that the effects of PBDEs on thyroid hormone production and function are likely to be involved in causing these impacts. Normal thyroid hormone levels and function are essential for brain development. In 2010, the first large study of the impacts of PBDEs on human brain development was published in the scientific literature. The scientists measured PBDE levels in maternal blood and umbilical cord blood of several hundred participants at the time of birth and followed their neurological development of the children over a period of 6 years, taking into account other factors that can also play a role. Standardized testing methods were used to measure neurological development of these children at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6 years of age. For virtually every measure of psychomotor skills, attention, learning, and memory, the children who were most highly exposed to PBDEs performed worse on testing than the children who were least exposed. Many of these differences were large enough to achieve strong statistical significance. It's worth noting that although the scientists did not analyze the blood for DECA-BDE, which contains 10 bromine atoms, as I've mentioned, DECA is biologically transformed into the lower brominated BDEs, including those that were measured and that caused the observed effects. This debromination has previously been shown in rodents, cows, fish, and birds. This transformation of DECA into the lower brominated compounds like penta and octa and others also occurs in the environment with exposure to sunlight. Thus, it is important that DECA be removed from commerce as well as penta and octa. So to conclude, in recent decades, human exposures to PBDEs have been steadily and rapidly increasing in the U.S. As long as we continue to use them in products, we will add to the environmental burden and ensure ongoing exposure in people and wildlife. We now know that they interfere with normal human brain development, just has been shown in a large number of laboratory animal studies. Safer alternatives are available, and I urge you to support this bill as a prudent measure to protect public health and the environment. And, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Hearing none, we'll go to Chris Hall.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Hall with the Ark of Anchorage. The Ark of Anchorage would like to thank you for introducing SB 27. The ARC serves people with developmental disabilities and mental health issues. Learning and developmental disabilities influence the quality of life for affected children and their families. Also impose a heavy financial burden on the state through required special education, increased health care costs, and lost work at time at work for parents, and a lifelong loss of work productivity for severely affected children. Scientific evidence has demonstrated that some chemicals, including DECA-BDE, can cause learning and developmental disorders. We must not expose our children to toxins that we know or suspect can harm their developing brains and bodies. We know safe alternatives can replace the need for these toxic chemicals without compromising fire safety. Developing children are more susceptible to toxic exposure than adults. When certain exposure occurs at certain times, sometimes even at very low doses, the development of children's brains and other organs and reproductive, hormonal, and immune systems can be permanently altered. Recent evidence has shown that children who had higher cord blood concentrations of PBDEs scored lower on tests of mental and motor development at 1 through 4 and 6 years of age. This work was initiated based on a large body of research indicating that prenatal PBDE exposure has the potential to disrupt neurodevelopment. PBDE residues, particularly highly brominated PBDEs such as DECA-BDE, have been found consistently in tissue samples of both new mothers and their newborn infants, as well as mothers' breast milk. Ingestion of contaminated milk is one of the two major routes of PBDE exposure in children. And there are other concerns about the high concentrations ingested given the susceptibility of newborns. This trend has been found to occur around the globe. Yupik women from the Kuskokwim Delta of Alaska have the highest known concentrations of PBDEs in human populations in the Arctic. Thank you for your time, and the ARC has no vested interest in this other than we would like to see lower rates of developmental disabilities.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Hearing none, I'll go to Greg Patterson.
Yes. Can you hear me there, Senator?
Yes, we do.
This is Greg Patterson, and I testified before your committee last year. I'm a retired firefighter. I was with the volunteer force in Petersburg, and a number of other, a number of other Alaskan communities out in the Kuskokwim, et cetera. I really applaud the effort to protect us and to protect our children. When I testified last year, it was after I had read the CDC, the Center for Disease Control's report in Atlanta that said that all these studies that these folks are quoting are inconclusive, that the head body at the CDC still has no definitive answers on these chemicals. My point is, as a former firefighter, I just wish that I could put into everyone that's sitting there in this body, put into your mind pictures of of children and people that I've had to take out of fires, that my colleagues have had to take out. I say to you, with the greatest respect, you better make damn certain that what you're doing is not going to increase the burn children in the Shriners hospitals. You know, from everything that I understand, ladies and gentlemen, the studies from the CDC are still inconclusive. If we're going to ban these, let's do it correctly and phase them out and make darn certain that we've got something to replace them with. That's I think that's what I have to say. Just be judicious, be careful what you're doing before you scream that the sky's falling. Thank you very much, Senator. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Here and none at this time, I'll go to Peter Brigham.
Hello?
Yes?
Yes, my name is Peter Thering, and I wanted to thank the senators for taking time to look at this issue. And I've been following things that you've done, and I followed this from last year and called in to talk to you guys last year, and you guys do a great job, and I think have looked at this issue pretty carefully. And I'm in agreement with the firefighter that just called. Couple things, since I was on last year, I've noticed that this year the bill has been changed, as we were just brought up to here, and there's been some loopholes and some scientific things that have changed around, which kind of leads me to believe that it might not be as rock solid as they're telling us. And just from a personal experience, I've heard a lot of reading from the other side and prepared statements that sound a lot alike. And I had a nephew that we were camping back east, and we had a fire going, and he was in a sleeping bag, and sparks flew off of the fire, hit his face, hit the sleeping bag. We had the fire. We actually had a paramedic come out because he was pretty badly burned on the face, and the paramedic, one of the things that they told us was the fact that sleeping bags today, using that fire retardant, saved his life, that the bag, had it not been there, would have caught on fire instantly. And I know of one life that was saved by the fire retardants we have now, and I just want to urge the committee to look at this and like they said, the guy said before, be judicious about it, and let's make sure we have some solid alternatives before we go cutting something immediately off. And I'll just listen offline and want to thank the committee for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Thoring. I have two Peters, and I had said Brigham. Is there a Peter Brigham there?
Yes, this is Peter Brigham.
Okay. Would you like to testify at this time?
Yes, I would. Thank you. I would like to testify in support of Senate Bill 27. I speak as a member of the burn injury community, in which I've been very active for the past 35 years. I've served as a major committee chair for the American Burn Association and been honored twice and been a member of their board of trustees. I do not speak for the association. I also speak as a founding director and emeritus board member of the Federation of Burn Foundations, which comprises some 50 groups that are around the country supporting local burn centers and burn prevention activities. This is a difficult issue for the burn community because it's quite understandable that anyone who treats severely burned patients or works closely with care providers and survivors would be inclined to support any action which might save a life or prevent such an injury. That was my own position until just 4 or 5 years ago when I first became aware of the increasing public health and environmental threat posed by the accumulating presence of these chemicals in the environment and in human tissue, as other speakers have clearly identified, along with the lack of any data that supports their effectiveness. Concern has been expressed about inconclusive studies. Well, we can't conclude the value of the flame retardant chemicals other than by very occasional anecdotes, which are actually quite rare. And we found in the last 30 years that we have found many ways to reduce fire death injury without the negative side effects that are result from these chemicals, as has been testified. These include numerous safety efforts like smoke alarms, greater public education, stronger building codes, safer designs of products like cigarettes, cigarette lighters, and candles. Unlike PBDEs, none of these influences have negative side effects, and they've had a combination of far greater positive impact than any that can be claimed for these chemicals. And there are other changes in society, not even motivated by fire safety, that have also helped reduce fire and burn casualties in the home. I've been tracking a lot of these developments as in my responsibility for compiling the annual update of the statistical incidence of fire and burn death and injury for the American Burn Association. And in that process, I've noted things like the major decline in smoking, the transition in home cooking from the stove to the microwave, and our increased reliance on food from restaurants and fast food outlets, which has reduced a major source of fires in the home. So for all these reasons, the growing threat of these chemicals, which we didn't know about 35 years ago. Most of us in the burn community had never heard of the word endocrine disruptor, which describes the reproductive influence, negative influence. This is the knowledge which the many studies that have been done continue to show. The conclusion that's been lacking is the ability to enact legislation at the federal level to respond to what these studies are showing. And that's why I applaud the state of Alaska for taking and for considering and hopefully taking the action represented in Senate Bill 27. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
I thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Hearing none, Dr. David Humbach.
Hello.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Senators. I am Dr. David Heimbach. For 35 years, I was the director of the University of Washington Burn Center at Harborview. We have, in that period of time, taken care of virtually all of the severely burned patients from Alaska, numbering well over 1,000 by this time. Many of them are children. Many of them come from the poorest of communities. I rise as a burn doc, not as a person that's particularly interested in any single fire retardant chemical, but the fact that they do work. The data that show, and what I'm suggesting is that we all want our environment to be clean, but we also want it to be safe. And in that regard, I think it is appropriate to hunt for safer retardants, but not to throw away the retardants that we have. Now, people speak of there are safer retardants. I don't know of any safer retardants that have been shown over the past 35 years, as has the decabromides been shown not to do any harm to anyone, and yet we're now banning them and perhaps replacing them with stuff that is really not been tested at all or not been tested for as long a period as these have. I must tell you, Mr. Brigham said that he only knew of a few anecdotal studies. I will tell you about an Alaska 6-month-old child who was in a crib. And in the crib, he had a fire-retardant pillow and a non-fire-retardant mattress. He was laying on it. A candle happened to spill over onto the bed, and the crib burned. The mattress burned almost instantly. The child sustained 50% very, very deep burns that required amputation of some toes. And yet his upper body was completely unburned, the part that was on the on the pillows. So I think we need to be careful before we just ban stuff that has been shown to be effective. keep in mind, please, for the firefighters and others who are concerned, that pure pine smoke, pure pine wood smoke, contains 280 known toxic chemicals. And so every one of those toxic chemicals in a smoky fire is causing damage. I just would hope that we're not like the people with airbags. When airbags first came out, there were a number of people who got burned because they are an explosion, after all, and then particularly the drivers who were holding onto the steering wheel would get forearm burns. Well, thankfully, they didn't decide to ban airbags because they caused some burns. And, in fact, they have gone on to show many, many, many lives saved, as well as improvements in the explosive capabilities. So I would hope that particularly in children's clothing, mattresses, things that do catch on fire and are right next to the potential burn victim, that we would be circumspect about banning things that have been very safe. As far as credentials go, I've been the president of the American Burn Association, as well as the president of the International Society for Burn Injury, as well as a governor of the American College of Surgeons, and many other national and international things. I thank you very much for listening to me, and I hope that that you will do better than the Washington legislature, who passed their bills without ever asking the opinion of any of our burn docs who take care of all the burn patients. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Yes, Doctor. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, and thank you, Doc, for the work that you've done on kids, and particularly Alaskan kids. Are you familiar with an organization called Citizens for Fire Safety?
I am. Yes.
Are they credible?
I'm sorry. Can you speak up just a little bit?
Yes, sir. Are they a credible organization?
I think they are, yes. I think they're made up of many people like me who have no particular interest in the chemical companies. Numerous fire departments, numerous firefighters, and many, many burn docs.
Right.
So I think they're credible.
Thank you, sir.
And Senator Eaton, do you have a question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, we'll continue with our testimony then. Is that Kathleen Higgins?
Senator Higgins, David, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Caitlin Higgins, Executive Director of the Alaska Conservation Alliance. The Conservation Alliance is an umbrella group with about 40 member organizations having a combined membership of over 38,000 Alaskans. We serve to advance conservation in Alaska and believe that a healthy environment and a strong economy go hand in hand. The Conservation Alliance strongly supports Senate Bill 27 and selected this legislation as one of our three priorities for the session. We'd like to thank Senator Wilikowski for sponsoring this bill and this committee for hearing it. I will keep my testimony short, as there are a number of experts who can speak much better to the incredible safety benefits of this bill. But the Conservation Alliance believes that this is a smart first step in making our homes safer and our families healthier. There are safer, cost-effective alternatives to PBDEs that are already being used successfully as flame retardants. It is time for Alaska to phase out the sale of these outdated toxic chemicals and keep Alaskans, especially our children, healthy. Thank you very much for your time, and the Alaska Conservation Alliance has no other vested interest in this bill other than it has been selected by our member groups as one of our priorities. Thank you.
Thanks. Any questions? Pam Miller?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would like to begin by thanking you, Chair Davis, and members of the committee for this opportunity to provide testimony on Senate Bill 27. My name is Pamela Miller. I'm a biologist and executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and we're a statewide environmental health organization that conducts research and provides educational programs, technical assistance, and training. We have no financial or vested interest in this legislation. Senate Bill 27 is an important measure to protect public health and especially the health of particularly vulnerable populations, including children, as well as firefighters who are on the front lines of exposure to these dangerous chemicals. Polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs, are similar in structure to the chemicals known as PCBs, which were banned more than 30 years ago, and thus have similar harmful effects on the body. PBDEs accumulate, they're long-lasting, and we're concerned about them because they interfere, as you've heard, with proper thyroid function in laboratory studies. They cause problems with brain development and disrupt learning, memory, and behavior. People are exposed to PBDEs through contaminated air, household dust, and foods. These chemicals leach out of products, and we are exposed through indoor air and dust. PBDEs harm childhood brain development and can contribute to learning disabilities that last into adulthood. Exposure to DECA and its breakdown products can harm women and children because they are passed to infants through breast milk and to children through contact with household dust. Levels in wildlife and people are increasing exponentially. PBDEs in human breast milk are increasing and doubling every 2 to 5 years. Levels in the U.S. are the highest of all countries for which there are data, and about 10 to 100 times greater than human tissue levels in Europe, where actions have been taken to reduce exposures. These chemicals are persistent. They can travel long distances via wind and ocean currents. They're now ubiquitous and found in northern air, sediments, and wildlife. And I believe that Alaskans are more vulnerable to exposures due to our higher levels of consumption of fish and marine mammals. And homes now in the north that are closed in for a greater part of the year. As mentioned before, women of childbearing age in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region of Alaska have the highest levels of any population in the circumpolar Arctic. Over the past year, new scientific evidence about the health effects of brominated flame retardants, I think, compels urgent action. Dr. Julie Herbstman of the Columbia University Center for Children's Environmental Health found that children who had higher prenatal exposures to PBDE scored lower on tests of mental and physical development at ages 1, 4, and 6. And Dr. Shetler reviewed that study, so I won't go into the details, but it's in my written testimony. Also in the past year, as Ms. Hart mentioned, 197 prominent scientists signed a consensus statement known as the San Antonio Statement on Brominated and Chlorinated Flame Retardants, and it was published in the December 2010 issue of Environmental Health Perspectives, the peer-reviewed journal of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. The statement names brominated flame retardants as a class of chemicals of concern for persistence, bioaccumulation, long-range transport, and toxicity. Among the 20 points that the scientists state, brominated and chlorinated flame retardants can increase fire toxicity, but their overall benefit in improving fire safety has not been proven. In summary, no one disputes the importance of fire prevention and safety. However, with the availability and economic viability of safer alternatives, it does not make sense to expose people, particularly children, to these toxic chemicals. In summary, we urge you to pass Senate Bill 27 in order to protect the health of vulnerable populations, including pregnant women, developing children, firefighters, and other workers, as well as the general public. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Hearing none, Garen Tarr? Garen Tarr?
Good afternoon, Senator Davis.
Yes.
My name is Garen Tarr. I work with Alaska Community Action on Toxics on environmental health policy and toxics reform. I want to thank the Senator Wilikowski for sponsoring the bill, Chair Davis for hearing the bill, and the other members of the committee for this opportunity to provide testimony. We've heard about the growing body of research that has PBDE exposure linked to many adverse health effects, ranging from thyroid function to reproductive health to even cancer. My testimony today is to remind us that adverse effects include more than just health problems, as health problems affect families, leaving children with sick parents, or a dad looking for answers as to why his son is having learning problems, or a mother wondering why they have noticed changes in their daughter's behavior. And we should not forget the cost of care, especially the cost associated with long-term care and the financial burden that puts on a family. I think Meredith Strang, Republican Senator of Maine, put it well in 2010 when she said in support of toxics reform in her state, as a cancer survivor, I know firsthand the physical, emotional, and financial toll these deadly diseases can take on families across the state. I support the Kids Safe Products Act because it will help prevent these devastating diseases, and that's good for our families and our pocketbooks. Much like the bill Senator Strang spoke in favor of, Senate bill has Alaska's future in mind and helps to protect, aims to protect young Alaskans from harmful exposures. Senate bill strikes the right balance between protecting public health, protecting local businesses, and the interests of Alaskans. And in closing, I've heard a lot of comments today about alternatives and whether alternatives exist. And I think we have historical examples to remind us what happens when we learn, you know, new information about the product. And I think a good analogy for this particular chemical is what happened with lead, right? At one point, that was widely used in many consumer products. And when we found out there were harmful effects, we found ways to make those products without them. We didn't stop painting our houses. We stopped painting them with paint with lead. We didn't stop driving cars. We stopped using gas with lead in it. So I think we need to remind ourselves that we can be innovative when we need to, and that human health and environmental health are a good standard to live up to. I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? There's one person in the audience. Is Cox? I'm not sure how to pronounce your first name.
Kristen.
I wanted to say that, but it spells so different.
Sloppy handwriting.
Yeah, right.
Thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Dr. Kristen Cox. I'm a naturopathic doctor, practice right down the street. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill number 27. As an Alaskan, a naturopathic doctor, a mother of a young child, and a lazy housekeeper, PBDEs are persistent in the environment and human tissues. They are absorbed through the skin and there's excreted by the kidneys into the urine as if they were ingested, yet they are not regulated relative to human health. They're found in household products, mattresses and furniture and baby products and electrical products, and the chemicals settle in our house dust, which, you know, exposes our children and ourselves. A lot of people have addressed already the plethora of health effects these chemicals have. As a doctor, I see an incredible number of thyroid problems. I'd say the majority of my practice is thyroid conditions, and that has, you know, downstream effects from elevated cholesterol, increased risk of heart disease, depression, weight gain, fatigue, inflammation, pain, et cetera, as well as developmental problems. The other condition that I see that has a great emotional and financial burden is infertility. And you only have to go to my daughter's preschool to see the number of twins in the classrooms these days to know that infertility is on the rise, and it's very devastating to families. PBDEs leach out of landfills into coastal areas and ocean sediments and are high levels in bivalves. As was already mentioned, and as we should well know in this state, that atmospheric currents and ocean currents bring toxic chemicals to the polar regions and concentrate them in the polar regions. This leaves the most vulnerable people and the most, the people that are least responsible for these toxins in our environment at the most, at the highest risk. I mean, it's heartbreaking to me that Alaskan Native women's breast milk is toxic. It's just beyond words for me. So just to sum it up, you know, I'm a mother of a small child. You know, the nursing pillow and rocking chair I use to nurse her can be up to 10% dry weight of these chemicals that can cause cancer, infertility, developmental delays, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, as a lazy housekeeper, I shouldn't have to worry that my house dust is toxic. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you for taking the time to testify. Any questions? Anyone else in the audience to testify? Come forward and state your name. Apparently, I don't have your name.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Lauren Hine. I am a doctor of environmental chemistry and environmental engineering, and I'd like to address the availability of alternatives. First of all, I spend a lot of my work is with businesses who develop products that are safe for human health and the environment, and a good alternative is one that provides fire safety but does not have the negative human health and environmental effects. The U.S. manufacturers of the PBDEs volunteered to stop manufacturing them in the U.S., Penta and Okta in 2004, and DECA will be banned in 2012-2013. That means that U.S. manufacturers are not making these chemicals. Banning these chemicals will not affect U.S. manufacturers of these chemicals. They are already making chemical alternatives, and so the ban will affect the import of products containing these chemicals made elsewhere. So these products are being made cheaply, dirtily, elsewhere, imported into products into the United States. We need to support the manufacturers of alternative chemicals here in the United States, and there are plenty of them. There are two programs. The EPA's Design for the Environment program has hosted a series of flame retardancy partnerships, one for Penta and one for DECA. The Penta had, there were at least 12 alternatives, and the DECA had 20 alternatives. This is a multi-stakeholder partnership based on the best available science, and people have absolute say into how these chemicals are evaluated. My organization, I work with an organization that developed a method for identifying safer alternatives called the Green Screen for Safer Chemicals. We have done work and shown that there are safer alternatives used for television casings. We've also done a report showing that many of the electronics manufacturers have found alternatives, including Apple, HP, Nokia, and more. They don't even use halogenated chemicals, never mind brominated PBDEs. Walmart, and this is in your packet, has recently prohibited, as of June 2011, they will not be buying any products from their suppliers that contain PBDEs. That should make the job of Alaska a lot easier, since Walmart is a very, very large retailer. They did this in part because of the number of state bans that have already occurred, but also due to concerns through part of their sustainability initiative. And in my world, working with a number of companies who have sustainability initiatives, who view that as the future of business and the future of all of us, they do want to move to safer alternatives, but they need signals from states like Alaska to say, yes, we will support you in moving to safer alternatives. I just want to mention one other thing. Mattress manufacturers, if you talk to them, Sealy, IKEA, and others, they now use a barrier technology. They no longer douse the foam itself. They use an inherently flame-retardant fabric to cover the mattress. So you're never compromising the flame retardancy itself. We're not banning flame retardants. You're not banning flame retardant regulations and standards. You're just banning those flame retardants that have the negative side effects. So I think this is really a great first step at using good science to identify safer alternatives and send the signals to retailers and manufacturers who want to use safer chemical alternatives. They don't want to be using toxic chemicals, and they wouldn't have used them in the first place if they'd known they had the health problems that they did and their safer alternatives were available. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have all your testimony in writing?
No. You have a packet that has the Walmart announcement and others.
We have that.
I'd be happy to give that if it was.
There is a question from Senator Dyson.
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing your expertise. You actually are somebody that knows what they're talking about. Really good.
Thank you.
Have the other states done something to either ban chemical abuse? use of imported materials that have this chemical?
As far as I know, and I would need to look at the specifics of the regs, that if you ban the sale of a product containing a flame retardant, then that means it wouldn't matter where it came from. Right. And one of the challenges, of course, is how do you know what's in it? So that's driving this huge movement for people to know what's in the products they sell. Most baby product manufacturers have no idea they're selling toxic flame retardants. So it forces that.
Would we then be putting the burden on each retailer or wholesaler to go through some process to make sure that what they're buying doesn't have these chemicals?
Yes, you would. One, it looks like part of your job would be done, given that Walmart has already decided to do this, but this is a pretty much a growing movement, and it's driven in part by Europe, I think, who has their REACH legislation, which is covers the manufacture and design of products. So any global company has to do this anyway. So, and I think most would agree that it is responsible to know what's in the products that you're selling. But yes, it would require you to pass that down the supply chain.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
We have completed the public testimony. There are people from the various agencies for questions. But at this time, we're going to close out public testimony and take up another presentation that we have to have, and we only have about 25 minutes to do that. So this bill will come back before us. If you have other questions or concerns, you should let it be known to myself and also to the sponsor of the bill. If you have some final remarks that you want to make while we're changing, okay, you're okay? All right. Okay, that would end the testimony on this then. It's Akilah House that's going to come before us at this time.
Madam Chair and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to be here for one reason. The esteemed chair said Akilah House, as do most of the people who live in Anchorage. Hasn't been Akilah House for over 10 years, but Akilah House is one of our programs. We just took off the house, and now it's just Akilah, Akilah Inc. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take advantage of the opportunity to speak to you because every year what happens with behavioral health, and it is now behavioral health, not substance abuse and mental health, new regulations will take effect the 1st of July, unless somebody jumps up and screams very loudly, and I think we're past that, that will make it behavioral health with the component regs that guide it in that way. That has changed a lot. And if you'll take a look at the little table of contents I gave you, I put this on the table of contents because I thought it was illustrative of what is happening in this field. If you'll note, FY92, Akilah House, and that was the only program we had at that point, the Akilah House budget was 682. In FY10, it was 681. In FY11, we got a $17,000 increase, so it's 696. It's about a 64% increase in cost of living since then. The reason I had this figure, that happened to be the year I went to work at Akilah, and I saved that first grant packet I had, and that's how I know that. Akilah has grown in a whole lot of ways in the past 20 years. It is now a full-service behavioral health organization with both substance abuse and mental health programs. It has grown in the last 5 years. Rather interestingly, you don't have these numbers, but I will share them with you. In 2006, our budget was
3.1 million. In 2007, it was 3.9. In 8, 5.6. In 9, 7.2. In 10, 8.9. And this year, we're projecting a 12.5 budget by the end of the fiscal year. We've done a lot of growing, and I think we may have a lesson that we could share with others. We've grown because what we've done is combine not programs as much as administration of those programs. There are now four, what were formerly five corporations that make up Aquila. The first to join us through a merger process was the Alaska Council on Prevention. We've been running that since 1999, I believe. In 2006, the Alaska Women's Resource Center, that was having a great deal of financial difficulty, asked us if we would take over and manage their programs. We did that for about 9 months. In that process, discovered that they were not financially stable, would not be able to maintain, shared that with their board. Their board, working with the Department of Behavioral Health, recommended that they dissolve as a corporation and their grants be given to us. We couldn't merge with them because their liabilities were just too large. It was too much of a burden for us to take on. But we were able to preserve the programs. So the Council on Prevention programs still exist because of the merger that eliminated double administration. We then added the Women's Resource Center, which did the same thing in 06. About that time, we decided that we thought we could do some things without patient service, without a grant. We didn't have a grant to provide outpatient services, but we bought a small for-profit private company and pulled that into our mix. So now we have this fee-for-service program. In 2009, actually 2010, this fiscal year, started in the spring last year, the division and the city of Ketchikan asked us if we would look at taking on the programs that run in Ketchikan. Those programs were complete behavioral health system. There was a pretty steep learning curve for us, and I think for them too, in that it was small and rural and hard to get to. The big, that came home very clearly to me when we had to have a stove in order to reopen their residential substance abuse program. We had to have the stove hood inspected. An inspector from Juneau goes to Ketchikan once a year, and if you miss that season, then you couldn't open your program because you couldn't get your hood inspected. That, for me, was a very big learning curve as to just exactly what we're talking about when we talk. And I don't think a lot of the folks in Ketchikan think of it as terribly rural because it's a fairly cosmopolitan-feeling small community, but it deals with those kinds of realities. The result is we brought that program in under our wing a year ago, the 1st of May. And I think it's going well. It is not an easy thing to do, but I've listened to colleagues who run very small programs. Copper Center was the most recent one, where all but crying. I don't get to sleep. I'm the only one. I'm doing all of the emergency calls. If I come down here, I'm still carrying my emergency telephone with me so I can get hold of the police or whoever in the case I get a call. If we're looking at cuts, we're going to destroy little community programs. I would like to encourage, and I don't know if it's a division, if it's the legislature, or if it's a combination, to look at, are there some ways that some larger organizations, and I'm not necessarily saying mine, I really believe that when you take one on, you need a couple years to help them get solidified and feeling good about who they are and what they're doing before you step into another large one. But at least on a regional basis, I would really encourage looking at administrative coordination. We didn't change the name of AWRC. You still have AWRC programs in the Anchorage. We didn't, and I'm not going to change the name of Gateway, which is a behavioral health program in Ketchikan, because we think it belongs to that community. And the minute I say you're no longer Gateway, you're Aquila, I've destroyed any goodwill we might have. But I think we can provide quality administration, quality financial services that they don't have. We've also been selling financial services. We have to pay for that big computer we bought to run it somehow. And we really have taken on contracts with small organizations to do their bookkeeping for them because we're familiar with how behavioral health grants and other funding sources must operate. So therefore, it makes it fairly easy for us when we have the capacity in our computer system to take on the bookkeeping and accounting functions for smaller organizations. So we've done that over the last several years. I think there are a number of creative ways we can all work together to save services in small communities and yet still do the kind of quality you have. I mentioned the behavioral health regs. Those are going to have a real driving effect combined with some of the things that Medicaid is doing. For instance, by 2013, we all must be on electronic medical record systems. We're in the process of doing that right now. I want you to know that is a painful process to go through. But we're in 18 communities in this state. I can't assure any kind of quality of records without being able to access those records. So we will be able to access records in the next few months to reach those programs. That's why we're doing this. We also have to do it if we intend to continue to collect Medicaid funding. The other thing that has happened with the new regulations is that the state has built into them required national certification or accreditation. So Aquila was already nationally accredited. We were accredited by an organization called CARF, the Commission on the Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities. I always have to stop and think what the acronyms mean. Most of you are aware of JACO, now calling itself the Joint Commission, and that is the accrediting entity that does most hospitals. We're in the process of moving from CARF to JACO because of the increased number of mental health patients we're seeing. We think that it's a better fit for us. That's a very expensive process for any agency to do. I can tell you that with an agency the size of mine, we're probably looking at $30,000 out of pocket. In addition, we are looking at one full-time and probably a combination of another FTE in just staff costs to assure that we are going to be able to get that accreditation. The state is mandating it. The state is not offering to pick up the cost of it. So all of your nonprofit behavioral health programs that are the backbone of services in that whole area of behavioral health really are now looking at how do we pick up these additional costs. The division is now saying we want to measure outcomes. Well, it's a little easier to measure outcomes in a mental health program than it is a substance abuse program, because substance abuse providers serve people who are really not proud of having been substance abusers. They're not going to go out and talk about what they did, where they did it, and how they did it. They're going to get on with their life if they're clean. So finding them and following up to see what they're doing 6 months, 12 months, 18 months post-treatment is very difficult and costly. You either have somebody who's on the street, if a lot of your people in your local community literally looking for them, You do a lot of telephone kind of contact. If you serve, like we do, people in bush communities, then that becomes a whole different thing. So we don't really know what outcome measurement is going to mean. We know what we're doing, and we are doing just exactly that. We're on the street, we're calling, we're doing follow-up. With Aquila House, we can do a criminal records check, and that becomes a pretty good indicator of outcome because about 96% of our people are felons. And so I can follow up after they've left treatment to see 6, 12, 18 months post-treatment, have they shown back up in the criminal justice system. Now, that may not say they have apple pie and roses kind of lifestyle, but they're not committing crimes anymore. And that's a key indicator for that kind of thing. One of the documents I gave you, it's the last one in your packet, is one that looks at outcomes from the state of Washington. And it talks about treatment in the community is cost-effective far beyond that. And Senator Ellis, you've written about this, far beyond the effectiveness of prison. So we need to find out better ways to put them in. We're sitting around in this state with the kind of criminal, alcohol, drug abuse-related activity that we have, and, by the way, the governor's new initiative, domestic violence, all the statistics say 80% of the cases have substance use involved by one or both of the individuals involved in the confrontation. It's a major driver of social ills in this state. And yet, you can look at what we've done with Aquila House's money and see that we really are not addressing it and not systematically looking at how do we make the best of this money we have, how do we check, what kinds of things do we do as a system to see whether what we're doing works. Does it pay off? The division has been involved for a long time, and I couldn't even begin to tell you what these initials stand for. They call it OISP, outcome something or another. The OISP study goes up to the day they're discharged from treatment. So if I keep somebody in treatment, they could leave my door, go across the street to the local bar, get drunk, and that's a success. But that same person could leave after 6 months in treatment, because Aquila is a long-term treatment program, say, I just can't deal with it anymore. That person could go, get a job, have his life together, do well. That's a failure because he didn't complete the program per OIS. So the outcomes studies we're doing are ineffective. They don't work very well. And they don't, because we're really trying to do it on the cheap. We don't want to spend the money it takes to do some solid follow-ups to see if people really are getting better. I think it's important. I think that we don't do it. On my board of directors is Dr. Bernie Siegel, and most of you from the Anchorage area know that Bernie has a long history working with alcoholism and those problems on the streets and in villages. So he's helping us now come up with our own outcome study. How can we do a better job of outcome analysis? But none of us can do that cheaply. It costs money. We really need to do there doesn't seem to be a place where we can come together and say, what can we do to help one another? Jeff Jesse from the Trust is talking about unmet capacity. We need more capacity. Because of the funding that you can see for Aquila House, and I use it as sort of my bellwether because it's the old one. It was the hallmark of where we started. I have half of that building sitting empty. Half my beds are empty because we don't have the money to fill them. Now, I contract some. I have contracts with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I have contracts with Federal Parole and Probation to put beds in there. I run prison programs in 9 institutions in the state. So we're pretty heavily involved to in-prison programs. We need to be looking at how we can get those people out of prison and into community programs with some ties on them, with ankle monitors, with any kinds of number of monitoring devices that are a lot cheaper than prison beds are, and getting them treatment at the same time. I think it's a philosophic shift that needs to happen, and we've been so busy just pedaling as fast as we can and not getting very far that we've not stopped to take a look at what would really work. What are the kinds of things we can do? And I'm sort of an old hand at this. I've been with Aquila for nearly 20 years, and I've been in social services for a whole lot longer than that. The only contemporary I have in this room is Betty. So I personally would like to offer my time, some of my staff's time, they'll love that, to take a look at how we do this. How can we do a better job of doing what we're doing now? Because there are some programs that aren't good, but most of the not good programs are not good because they continue to try to operate with inadequate resources. And we need to stop doing that because it gives us all bad names. And that's really what I wanted to bring to you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, we thank you for coming before us. And I thought this would be a great lesson for the full committee to hear, and wish more people could hear what you have to say. I was impressed when you came to my office not long ago telling me about the various programs that you had. I didn't know it expanded the way it has and the kinds of grants that you have out there, that you could go from a $682,000 budget to a $12.5 million at this time. Is impressive to me. And I see that these are things that the department is talking about, that they want to have some of the very things that you are achieving already, things that they want to happen.
I
would hope that more agencies could come together and see what they can share rather than each having their own little separate little compartment.
I think there's fear, what will happen to the people I serve. One of the things that happens, and those of us, and Madam Chair, you know this is where you came from, those of us who work in social work of any sort get caught up with our clients, and those are the people we serve. And the speech I give the people who work for me is, I start with a question, who's your client? And they all, it's Joey and Sammy and Bobby. I said, no. Your clients are your funders. You need to figure out what it is your funders want to see achieved and then work to achieve that. What has happened in this field, though, and I think for some good reasons, except it's unfunded mandates. When we began to do behavioral health, it said we have to have better educated, better licensed, better staff. Substance abuse was the stepchild because it had come out of the tradition of 12 steps, the AA tradition, and a lot of the people had no education. They were recovering users who got the message and quit and wanted to share that, and so they took a few classes, and ergo, they're a counselor. For a certain population, that works. And some of the good counselors are there. But as we bring more and more, particularly duly diagnosed folks with substance abuse and mental health problems, into a program, that AA background training really doesn't cut it. Because what they see as bad behavior is probably mental health issues, and we have to address those folks. Right now, I run a program that I'm immensely proud of, and it scares me to death, and that is my residential program for moms whose children are with them. The reason it scares me is that it is funded as a substance abuse program. We have, Senator Ellis has visited, we have 15, and we keep it at 15 because it's supported to a large extent by Medicaid, and if we go over 15, we lose our eligibility for Medicaid, which is a federal rule of one sort or another. We have mothers who live in individual apartments with their families. The mother can come into treatment. She must have her children with her within 30 days. Most of the children are OCS children. I currently have one baby in the hospital. She's 20, 21 months old. She's a failure to thrive baby who his mom was on meth when she was born. I don't know if that baby's going to survive, but I know that my substance abuse money allows me to hire babysitters. I have a small daycare on site, but it doesn't provide me funding to provide the services those children need. I took one of the people from the division through the program a few months ago, and he said, oh, you need to do more with those children. And he said, are you aware you have FAS children? I said, oh, you mean that little blonde girl you were talking to? Yeah, we're aware. We have several of them. We never are without FAS children. We're funded to do substance abuse services for their moms. We are not funded to provide services for the children. I'm currently looking for a way to do that, but part of it, if you start doing that, I have to have a pediatric psychiatrist that I have access to in order to provide services for those kids. The kids need service terribly. It actually frightens me to know that we have the responsibility of having children as needy as these are there. And we're the only program in the state that is set up this way. There are three programs that provide services for moms whose children are with them. Two of them are set up dormitory style. Ours has individual apartments for each family. So we're doing a whole lot of skill building with the moms, many of whom have never been. When I first took over, OCS thought they had an easy thing going and they dumped kids in there. I have the little two-bedroom apartments and I'd have a mom who had six children. And so I met with them and said, that isn't going to happen. We have moms who aren't moms because they don't know how to be. They haven't been. They've got a serious substance abuse problem, and you come in and dump six kids on them. We will take up to two children because we have a two-bedroom unit, and we won't take any more than that. That didn't make me very popular, but it's a much better program because we did that. And those are the kinds of things we're dealing with out there are pretty horrendous, and I think more so than most people realize. We all have the picture of the drunk down on Fourth Avenue or Front Street and one town or another. We don't see them. They're there, but they're not the ones who end up in the treatment programs. Ours tend to be a little younger usually. They have gotten there because they've committed a crime and the judge says, thou shall or thou shall go to jail, and they arrive with us. They're threatened by losing their children, so that gets them into treatment. It's a different population. So when people make judgments about, well, my Uncle Sal was a drinker and he was for 40 years and nobody could have stopped him, they don't see the clients we have. It's a very different thing. We have the same kind of thing in Ketchikan and in every prison we work in. It is heartrending. It is a cost to this state. There are better ways of providing services to reduce the cost to the state while providing better service.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Dyson?
Oh, I appreciate what you've been doing and the successes you've had. I assume that there's not enough money in this governor's budget to do the things you believe you need to do.
I think if you look at where we were and where we are now, it's been a stepchild, and that has come as a result of some misunderstanding, particularly in the substance abuse side of the house, that started with the Murkowski administration. With the commissioner then thought that you could take care of everything with Medicaid, and most of our clients are not even eligible for Medicaid.
I think your answer is yes.
There isn't enough money, but I'm not blaming this governor. What I'm saying is there's a long history behind that. And I think that
the reality is we're not stupid. All of us understand that we're beginning to look at, oh, my gosh, will we have a break in that pipe? And so let's look at how can we do this better.
Yeah, believe it or not, we aren't either. But let's get to the bottom line. What do you want us to do?
I don't particularly – I'm not even asking you for more money. What I'm asking you to do is take a look at this. Let's take a look at helping the department and division come up with a better way of looking at this. Let's talk consolidation. Let's talk about funding something real when it comes to outcomes, and then we'll get rid of people who are not doing what needs to happen in the field. We'll retain those that are better, and we'll make everybody get better by doing it. But don't provide the providers with a handful or a whole hoping full of unfunded mandates. They're struggling anyway, and now you're saying, oh, you got to do this too. And we haven't done a good we've not done a good thought process, the what if question. Right. If we do this, what will happen? What if this happens?
So do you want us to recommend a task force or a study group?
I think that would be a great idea. I truly think that would be a great idea, particularly as we're moving into behavioral health with a whole new method of operating these programs. Because they're going to change dramatically as a result of this.
Can you point us to other jurisdictions who have done this really well or much better than us? Can we follow their paradigm?
Seattle's done quite a bit in this way, but let me get some stuff and I'll get it back to you.
I would suggest you get it to our chairman.
When I said you, I meant you collectively, with it going to the chair to come to you.
I think everybody at this table really cares and understands a bit and appreciate what you're trying to do, but I'm trying to figure out how to get where we're at to where we should be.
I think we can help with that. But I do think it's important that we look at it. I've been involved in something called the OISP Committee for 7 years now. I don't think it provides us anything we need.
Thank you, Senator Dyson, for bringing that up. There are lots of things that need to be discussed, brother. We're not able to do it now. We've come to our 3 o'clock time, and we have to adjourn at this time. We want to take this opportunity to once more thank you for coming before us and sharing with us your programs.
Madam Chair, I carry my little tambourine everywhere, so just let me know when you want to hear it again.
And with that, we're going to adjourn at 3 o'clock.